Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, U.S. officials now say that al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi initially survived a U.S. airstrike. Officials said yesterday the two 500-pound bombs dropped on a safe house north of Baghdad killed Zarqawi instantly. This morning, Major General Bill Caldwell briefed reporters at the Pentagon from his post in Baghdad with the surprising new details of Zarqawi's death.
The first people on the scene were the Iraqi police. They had found him and put him into some kind of gurney stretcher kind of thing, and then American coalition forces arrived immediately thereafter. Zarqawi attempted to sort of turn away off the stretcher. Everybody re-secured him back onto the stretcher, but he died almost immediately thereafter from the wounds he had received from this airstrike.
UPI Pentagon correspondent Pam Hess was at the briefing and joins us on the line from the Pentagon. And Pam, is there any sense of how Zarqawi could have survived, even briefly, such a massive airstrike?
General Caldwell suggested that it's possible Zarqawi had left the building at the time when the bombs came down. He might have been just outside, so what he would have received was not the full brunt of the attack, but shrapnel and pieces of the building coming after him.
And does that suggest he may have been tipped off?
We don't know that, and I'm not sure that that's something we're going to find out. But what it does open up is a whole other set of questions that we at the Pentagon are trying to pursue, and that is something else that General Caldwell brought up in the interview today. The shots were taken by two F-16s, we were told yesterday. Later yesterday, they clarified that only one of the two F-16s dropped its ordnance, which was a little bit strange because normally you have two aircraft and one would use one weapon, the other would use the other. It's just sort of how they do things. You always want two at the same time anyway, so that you have two eyes on the target. Well, we found out today that one of the F-16s was stuck on a tanker getting refueled in the air, and so the other F-16 was called in to take this shot. Yesterday, we were told by an Air Force three-star general who's in charge of air forces in the Middle East that this was not a time-sensitive target, that they had plenty of time to line up their shot. And what we hear today is that it seems that it was a time-sensitive target, because if it wasn't time-sensitive, they could have waited for the other plane to come off the tanker. So that's what makes us think that Zarqawi had left the building and they needed to take the shot immediately.
Well, did General Caldwell say why the story has changed now?
What you have to understand is after an operation like this, it's almost like a big game of telephone, even for the military. If you weren't there to see it with your own eyes, you're getting filtered reports. General Caldwell went today, we think, to the Bakuba area to interview the folks who had carried out the operation to read the reports that came down. And then he flew back to Baghdad to give us the updated information. So it's always, you can never really trust what comes out immediately after a strike, and I think we're going to get a lot more interesting details on this as the days go on.
Well, let's talk about some of the more details we got just this morning. Can you tell us more about what happened when Zarqawi was found? Was he conscious? Did he say anything?
Apparently he mumbled a little something. It sounds like he was pretty out of it. What General Caldwell said was that he was on a stretcher when the U.S. forces had gotten there. The Iraqi police were first on the scene. They put him on a stretcher. They said that he made a move as if to get off the stretcher, was restrained, and died shortly thereafter. We don't have any more details as to what went on. He apparently mumbled something. He was very indistinguishable, very short. We don't have a translation of what it was, what he said. So all we know is that he lived through the initial blast.
And General Caldwell said Zarqawi died from wounds sustained in the airstrike. But some reporters asked whether there were any other wounds, such as from bullet wounds. When will we have those answers?
They are thinking about conducting an autopsy now. There's been an examination of the body, but I'm not sure that it goes to the level of autopsy. You have to have doctors involved and forms filled out. So when we find out if there has been an actual autopsy, we'll see if there were bullet wounds. There are a lot of theories out there as to what might have happened. We don't know if the Iraqi police had anything to do with it, but I think that the conspiracy theorists might be a little far out, because it's pretty hard to survive two 500-pound bombs on a building, even if you are just outside of the building. One of the things that General Caldwell corrected is that there were not seven casualties in this, but six. Three were male, three were female. They said yesterday they thought there was a woman and a child involved in the dead. Today he thinks that there were no children, that there were three women and three men. Two of the men have been identified. One of them, obviously, is Zarqawi. One is Abdul al-Rahman, which is his spiritual advisor. It is the guy that they tracked in order to find Zarqawi. and then we don't know yet the identities of the other four.
And there were also some questions about the photos presented of Zarqawi. Apparently, he was cleaned up for the photos. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, they pulled the blood off of his face, so they cleaned him up physically. They denied that they did any digital enhancement of the photos, but they wanted to show, A, that he was dead, but B, not show all the blood. I think it was probably a pretty grim picture.
And does that also explain why the photos were framed?
I'm not sure why the photos were framed. We haven't really gotten a good explanation on that, so we don't know that yet.
Pam Hess is the Pentagon reporter for UPI. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
For more on the Zarqawi story, we now go to Baghdad, where Washington Post correspondent Nelson Hernandez is following the story. And Nelson, your paper was one of the first to report that Zarqawi was initially alive. What does General Caldwell say match up with what Iraqi eyewitnesses told your paper?
There were some slight differences. We had a special correspondent who tried to gain entrance to Hibhib, which is the town slightly northeast of Bakuba, where Zarqawi was killed. And what our correspondent told us there was that he'd spoken to police officers and hospital officials who told him that Zarqawi's body actually did make it to the hospital and that he was still alive and in a state of being seriously wounded when American troops arrived and took the body away. But we've been unable to confirm whether that account is actually true.
We were just talking with Pam Hess at the Pentagon about why the photo of Zarqawi was framed. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I can. Unfortunately, the answer to that is not so exciting. I've been to several of those briefings at which the general has spoken and his predecessor, General Lynch, has spoken. And they just use those frames for all of the briefing. It's basically a wood backing with a gold frame, and they tape on paper slides that they use to display whatever information that they're looking to convey. So those gold frames have framed maps and pictures of weapons caches and other terrorists who have been captured.
So ease of display. Well, Nelson, what are people in Iraq saying about this new information about how Zarqawi died?
I haven't gotten a real sense of what the reaction to this is. You know, there was a little bit of curiosity about his death, of course, and the circumstances of it, but I've been actually a little bit surprised that there haven't been more, conspiracy theories, people thinking that he might still be alive. I think the general consensus over here in a country rife with rumors is that he really is dead, and nobody's really questioning that. I haven't gotten the sense of what they have to say about his final words or his final moments yet.
Officials found maps and computers at the safe house where Zarqawi was staying. Are there any new details on what else was found at the house?
The military has kept that pretty close to the vest because it's, intelligence operations. And they don't want to give away the methods of how they collect intelligence. But they have said that, they got memory sticks, for example, and hard drives. And the information that they found, General Caldwell said yesterday, prompted them to launch 17 raids simultaneously across the country. We've learned today that there have been 39 other raids in the last 24 hours or so on other suspected al-Qaeda safe houses. We don't have a sense of how successful or what they've gotten out of those raids, but the obvious conclusion is that they found a lot of information that has prompted them to launch a widespread effort to dismantle the al-Qaeda network.
And today, President Bush said that Iraqi leaders may have underestimated how long it will take to quell violence in Iraq. They had estimated 18 months. Are they still saying that?
I've been calling around to Iraqi government officials all day to get a sense of, are they confident now in this new government that took office about 3 weeks ago? And every single member I've spoken to, and this is for all three, ethnic and sectarian groups in Iraq, the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds, they've all said that it's going to take a long time, and a lot of them didn't want to vouch a guess or hazard a guess as to how long it might take.
Nelson Hernandez is a Washington Post correspondent in Baghdad. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, what is still not known and may not be known for months is what effect the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi will have on the Iraqi insurgency. For some answers, we turn now to Farhana Ali, a terrorism expert at the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. And Farhana, what are your thoughts on a successor, and why hasn't one been named yet?
Actually, a successor has been named soon after Zarqawi's death. You know, one thing the jihadis have always proven that they can do best is not only fight, but that they can survive. So soon after his death, a successor was named, and his name is Abu Abdul Rahman al-Iraqi. He is actually the deputy emir of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that just proves that, you know, that the organization has been preparing for this moment for a long time. They probably knew one day that Zarqawi would die, and just as, and that is actually a hallmark, not only of the jihadi or the insurgency in Iraq, but a hallmark of al-Qaeda at large. They know how to replenish their ranks, and so that as soon as a leader is either captured or killed, detained, they're immediately able to replace that leader with someone who's able to carry on the organization.
Well, will he be accepted by all the different factions in the insurgency? Is he widely viewed as the successor to al-Zarqawi?
I think he is. If you look at you have to look at some of the jihadi internet postings where the jihadi groups in Iraq have already pledged their support for him. They've already congratulated him, and he has stepped up to the plate and offered his condolences and made, you know, remarks about where he intends to take the insurgency. The basic point is that, the loss of Zarqawi is, all the jihadis, whether it's in Algeria, the GSPC group, or in Afghanistan, even Taliban, Mullah Umar has made, you know, remarks about the new replacement. And the basic image, the message, is that their resolve has only strengthened because of it. So, yes, Zarqawi is gone, but they have someone else to replace him, and the movement of this insurgency will continue.
So you say al-Iraqi has already said what he plans to do with the insurgency, where he plans to take it. What has he said?
Well, it's not so much what he has indicated is that he will continue to carry the mantle of jihad in Iraq. And in his statements actually mirrors other statements that have been made. For example, one of the emirs of the Mujahideen Shura Council in Iraq, which is also another leading group to which al-Qaeda in Iraq adheres to, you know, they have viewed Zarqawi's death and said that actually it has opened, the gates of paradise have opened within Iraq because of this death. And so the entire image is that he continues to carry on the insurgency, probably with greater resolve than what Zarqawi has been able to do. In other words, you know, Zarqawi is, and if you look at the jihadist chatter, is just falls in the line of martyrs in heaven. I imagine that if al-Iraqi will, you know, be killed or captured tomorrow, they will have someone else to replace them. So they continue to replenish their ranks.
So you don't see any sign of violence decreasing or the movement splintering with the death of al-Zarqawi?
No, I don't. In fact, it's an interesting point that you raised, because this is a point that has been made by other terrorism experts who predict that there will be this immediate decline in violence as the local jihadis are regrouping, or that they continue to debate positions of internal power and leadership. And from what I see from the, you know, jihadi websites, there is no dispute over power. And, you know, a leadership, a successor has been named, and the insurgency will likely continue.
Farhana Ali is a terrorism expert at the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's more coming up here and now. NASA, and the first thing that comes to mind is space travel. But NASA also has other missions, a key one being the study of the Earth. And a story in today's Boston Globe says that NASA is canceling or postponing several key programs that would provide scientists with information about global warming and the environment. Joining us on the line is Beth Daly, who covers environmental issues for the Boston Globe. Hi, Beth.
How are you?
Good. First, let's go through some of the programs you cite in today's story. First, the one at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It's a satellite mission that studied moisture in the soil. Explain what's happening.
NASA agreed to build this project called HYDROS about 2 years ago, but last December, the principal investigator got a message saying the mission was absolutely canceled. And it's an important mission because HYDROS was going to study soil moisture. And soil moisture is a very, very important measurement that scientists have been missing in this sort of the climate change conundrum and also weather, because soil moisture eventually evaporates And that evaporation contributes to this carbon energy and water vapor cycle that helps drive atmospheric change and weather, as well as help scientists understand climate change over a long period of time. The project has only spent about $5 million. It's not clear if it will ever be back on the drawing board, but scientists are bemoaning it because it was going to provide a very unique set of information. Another really important satellite that's been canceled, or it's called the Deep Space Climate Observatory.
That was canceled earlier this year, right?
It was. And the Deep Space Climate Observatory, for those astute listeners will remember, was once called GORSAT because it was sort of conceived and proposed by Al Gore.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to sort of give the world a continuous view of the world, much like the Apollo mission did years ago, this beautiful globe that everyone kind of remembers in their head. And he wanted to beam it on the Internet. It grew a lot since then into a more scientific endeavor, and that was going to observe climate factors such as solar radiation, ozone clouds, and water vapor that would both help improve weather prediction and understand how our climate works. It's already built, but it's been canceled.
Tell us about the fate of the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission.
Yeah, the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission was going to be launched to provide a very, very accurate measurement of basically all the precipitation that falls on the globe, the rain, the ice, the snow, to give scientists, again, sort of a better handle on how much is normal, what are the long-term trends. The reason why it's so important to be launched soon is that there's another satellite doing the job now that's not expected to last very long. So by delaying the global precipitation measurement, NASA is essentially creating a large gap in data that scientists say might prove disastrous in the future.
Well, how disastrous? What does this mean exactly? How does it affect everything from weather predictions to looking at global warming?
It does. And I think the gaps that scientists are most concerned about is global warming. Despite all the press and lots of media on climate change and global warming, scientists still don't have a good grasp of understanding, you know, the day-to-day aspects that contribute to it and the long-term monitoring that they need to basically say, okay, this is normal, this is not normal, and how do we plan for the future? And that's where instrumentations like these satellites, like the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, is very handy. It provides a sort of a continuous stream of information for scientists to understand baseline data to compare future change against. It also improves weather forecasting as well.
Well, that's what I was going to say. How might this affect hurricane predictions?
You know, it's not that we're not going to be able to predict hurricanes, but the thing that everyone wants to know, like Katrina, they want to predict hurricanes with incredible, incredible accuracy, that it's going here, it's coming, it's going to do this. And to do that, you need to really have a lot of eyes in the sky looking at hurricanes, understanding them, how they move, you know, how quickly they're moving and what they tend to do, and that may suffer.
What does NASA say about these cuts?
You know, NASA is upset about the cuts as well. They don't want cuts to the Earth science budget. In fact, these cuts extend throughout the entire science budget, everything from astrobiology to microgravity. But they have a different mission now from the president, and they are required to spend a lot of money attempting to get astronauts back on the moon and complete the International Space Station.
So that's where the money's going?
Exactly. They need cash to do that, and an awful lot of it. So over the next 5 years, while they had projected giving something like $3 billion extra to science missions, they're now taking that away, which is why scientists are so upset. And Earth science, while it's suffering no deeper cuts than other science disciplines, some scientists argue it's the most important, given the lack of information we have on some issues in climate change, and also that it helps so much with weather prediction, and even helps the military out with, like, figuring out how to drive over terrain. You know, they can determine, these weather satellites can determine if the ground is wet or dry, and that will help improve, you know, military maneuvers.
Beth, do you think there's any indication that these cuts are payback in some sense? There are many allegations that the Bush administration has tried to squash warnings from researchers about global warming.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of scientists I talked to, and I talked to quite a few, had that as sort of a subtext, although no one said it overtly. But when I asked people straight out, no, they don't think this is some sort of payback that the administration doesn't want to learn about climate change. And the reason they say that is that the cuts are spread pretty evenly throughout the entire science budget in NASA. But they do say at a time when we should be learning more about climate, and everyone remembers Katrina, we should be able to better predict some hurricane paths. It's not the time to be cutting the Earth Science budget in any way, shape, or form.
Well, thank you very much, Beth.
Okay, thank you.
Beth Daly is the environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Next week on Here and Now, summer's approaching. Time to get out your summer reading list. We'll have some suggestions. That's next week. Stay tuned with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program's
quarter century, most medical industry groups have been predicting a glut of doctors in the United States. And the estimates were taken so seriously that the country stopped opening medical schools in the 1980s. Today, those same groups say the country could be facing a national health care crisis in the future because of a shortage of doctors, and medical school enrollment should increase. They say there are already signs of a problem, pointing out that 1 in 5 Americans lives in an area designated as underserved by doctors. But critics say more doctors does not necessarily mean better health care. Ed Salzberg is director of the Association of American Medical Colleges Center for Workforce Studies, which is predicting the doctor shortage. And Ed, explain why you think there'll be a shortage in the future.
Well, there are a number of reasons for predicting the shortage. They're related to both supply and demand factors. On the supply side, we have an aging physician workforce. In fact, we have about 1 in 3 doctors in America are over the age of 55 and will be nearing retirement. There are also many reports that younger doctors are more interested in a balanced life and not interested in working those long hours that doctors have historically done. And because of the numbers of physicians we educated in the past and because we stopped expanding medical education in 1980, the number of physicians in America will be peaking in the coming years. At the same time, and one of the major drivers here is on the demand side, the number of elderly Americans, those over 65, will be doubling over the next 20 years. And the elderly, we know that the elderly use far more services than younger Americans. In fact, those over 65 use more than 6 visits per person to a physician per year, while those in their under 65 use less than 3. So by adding, by the increase, the doubling of the elderly population, we expect we will see a greater demand for physician services. But also the nation is growing very rapidly. The U.S. population is growing by about 25 million every decade. Unfortunately, this growth in demand is going to come at a time when the physician supply will be nearing a peak.
And in what areas of medicine would the shortage be the greatest?
Certainly specialties serving the elderly, whether it's cardiology or oncology, urology, are likely to experience shortages or certainly increases in demand. But we think the issue will be more widespread across specialties in the U.S.
And what about in areas in the country where there could be shortages greater than in other areas?
Well, our concern is that the shortages will be greatest in those areas that are already experiencing shortages, such as rural communities and inner city areas. If the total demand exceeds the total supply, one would expect that will be most serious in areas that are currently underserved.
And you've recommended increasing enrollment at medical schools now to address this shortage. And by how much?
The Association of American Medical Colleges has recommended that U.S. medical schools increase capacity by 15%, but our executive council is meeting next week and is expected to endorse a recommendation that U.S. medical schools increase capacity by 30%.
Why double?
Well, a 30% increase would lead to an increase, by the way, this increase would be phased in over the next decade, and it would lead to an increase of about 5,000 additional new doctors each year. This actually, while it sounds like a large number, actually would not even produce the number of doctors that some studies, including the Federal Council on Graduate Medical Education, has recommended that the nation will need in 2020.
Even increasing it by 30% wouldn't be enough?
Here's a really important issue that people often fail to understand, is it takes a very long time to increase the physician supply. You know, if you decide today that you want to add medical school capacity, it will take you 1, 2, 3 years to add faculty and classroom space and enroll the additional students. And then it takes 4 years of medical school and, as you know, 3 to 8 years of graduate training. So even if we decide today to increase medical school enrollment, we're not going to see significant new physicians until after 2015. So if you recognize that the baby boom generation is going to be reaching beginning to reach the age of 70 in 2016, and we need 10 years to increase the physician supply, that we really need to get moving relatively soon in order to produce doctors that will be available in 2015 and 2020.
Have some U.S. medical schools already moved to expand their enrollment?
We survey the schools each year to see what their plans are regarding expansion. And based on current plans of existing schools and new schools, we expect that we'll see about a 10% increase in medical school enrollment over the next several years.
You're asking for 30% on top of these percentages of increases that schools are already doing.
When we say 30%, it's really 30% compared to the number of the enrollment in 2002. And so we've begun to see, and the plans, there are plans already to increase some, and what we're encouraging them is to increase their plans.
Well, who pays for this in the end is Medicare, and can it afford a 30% increase, and how would you propose paying for it?
In terms of payment, about two-thirds of our medical schools are state-sponsored, and decisions about expansion of medical school capacity and how much to expand and in fact, in part, to pay for this, will come at the state level by states. But the reality is that to produce a doctor or a new doctor, you have both undergraduate and graduate medical education. Graduate medical education, which is an essential part of the pipeline of producing new doctors, is funded in large part or heavily by the Medicare program. As I said, one of the major drivers of the additional demand for physicians, one of the reasons we're going to need physicians, is because of the number of growing elderly. You know, those over the age of 65 are going to grow from 25 to 50 million over the next 25 years. So since the demand is going to be driven by Medicare, it is appropriate that Medicare increase or continue to support the production of physicians.
Critics say this isn't supply and demand. They may agree that there could be shortages in some medical subspecialties, but they say more does not mean improved health care, and we should be looking at improving the system and training doctors in new approaches. How do you respond to that?
We're not suggesting that the only solution is more physicians. In fact, I think it's absolutely critical that the nation find ways to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of health services. We just think that you have to have a minimum number of physicians as part of that revised and improved delivery system.
That's Ed Salzberg. He's director of the Association of American Medical Colleges Center for Workforce Studies. The group, which represents medical schools, predicts that a shortage of doctors could create a national healthcare crisis as baby boomers age. You're listening to Here and Now.
We've been talking about predictions of a shortage of physicians in the United States. We just heard the case for increasing enrollment at medical schools in order to train more doctors. But Dr. David Goodman, professor of pediatrics and family medicine at Dartmouth Medical School in New Hampshire, has a different view. More doctors, he says, doesn't necessarily mean better health care.
The studies are very consistent in this. Both studies looking at end-of-life care, at the care of Medicare beneficiaries, as well as studies at the beginning of life. What's important is what doctors do, but the actual number of doctors doing it in a particular healthcare system has relatively little influence on what patients experience and the outcomes from their care.
What about access to the doctors? In some areas, you can wait more than a month to get an appointment with a doctor.
Yes, it's true, and this is one of the areas where we need to have improvement, but it really speaks to how systems of care and how physicians are organized, because we know from our research that you can be waiting for months for an appointment in a place that has exceedingly high supply of physicians and waiting for a month for an appointment in a place that has only 50% or 30% of the per capita supply. So it seems odd, but the research is very consistent that access is much more related to how care is delivered than the sheer number of physicians.
And if you would talk about some specific cases, I know you looked at New York University versus the Mayo Clinic and how patients received care, how quickly, and how their outcomes related to the number of doctors at each of those medical centers.
What we found is that there are places, and New York University Medical Center is one example, where the number of physician full-time equivalents, so think of it as a number of physicians caring for 1,000 of these patients, was as high as 28. And other places, Mayo Clinic, where only 9 were required. Certainly no one would argue that the Mayo Clinic is delivering substandard care. If these other healthcare systems were practicing with such quality and such efficiency as the Mayo Clinic, we certainly would not have any concerns about an impending physician shortage.
One of the recommendations from the Association of American Medical Colleges is to increase enrollment at U.S. medical schools. What do you say to that recommendation?
What's important is the quality of care that patients receive and access. And the biggest problem with access today is not number of physicians, but it's whether you have health insurance or whether your health insurance is adequate. These are well-defined problems in our healthcare systems for which we have a consensus for quality and affordability, and that's where we should be putting extra resources.
And what about affordability? It's Medicare that's paying for a graduate medical education. It's what reimburses the hospitals for the cost of training these medical residents.
Well, I think as a society, we can certainly afford to do whatever it takes to make our healthcare system of better quality and more available to patients. The problem with trying to solve problems of quality and access by just dumping more physicians into the marketplace is that that's been shown not to be effective at all.
So what would you recommend? Because it sounds to me like this could be more of a better management issue, a business issue, and not an issue of too few doctors.
Right. In fact, I think that for many observers of the healthcare systems and healthcare analysts, the concept of a physician shortage is ironic at best. We know ways that we can improve our healthcare delivery system, and there is many efforts around the country to do that. We've made great progress in terms of improving quality and accessibility of care. We certainly need to continue to measure what's going on in the workforce. It's also ironic that the federal ability to measure the workforce has essentially disappeared. We no longer have a Center for Workforce Analysis at the Bureau of Health Professions. The Association for American Medical College has really the largest shop in town now, and they are certainly driving the workforce agenda today.
So improve healthcare delivery, don't add more doctors. Well, Dr. Goodman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. David Goodman is professor of pediatrics and family medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Thank you. violin virtuoso turn after two phenomenally successful collaborations with none other than Edgar Meyer and Yo-Yo Ma. Ask Mark O'Connor. He's the creative force for the trio that helped define the Americana music genre with Appalachia Waltz and the follow-up Appalachia Journey. Mark O'Connor has assembled a new Appalachia Waltz trio with emerging talents who found their chops playing his songs, distinctive compositions that unite classical chamber music with traditional American twang, like the edgy Blackberry Mull. It's one of the songs featured on Crossing Bridges from the Appalachia Waltz Trio. Founder, fiddler, violinist, and composer Mark O'Connor joins us now. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
And also joining us with violin in hand is Mari Black. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Mark O'Connor, first of all, what is the Tennessee Fiddle Camp?
The concept of the camp is 5 days of string instruction where students will come from literally all over the world to meet with faculty members that are experts in the fields of classical, jazz, all kinds of world music, and every imaginable range of fiddling you can think of.
Well, Mari Black, you attended the Tennessee Fiddle Camp, and now you teach there. How and when did you add fiddler to your musical resume?
I was fortunate to grow up in a household that was traditionally classical music, but my mother went through a period of wanting to expand her own stylistic horizons, and so I grew up listening to French-Canadian fiddling, and then I went to Mark's camp, and my life changed forever. I had things like jazz in my ears, but not really in my musical knowledge, and for 5 days, I got to be overloaded with the material that I would be working on probably for the rest of my life.
Well, Mark, both of the musicians performing with you on the recording, they listened to the Appalachia Waltz songs that first came out in 1996 from an early age, and you write that they appreciate a broad range of styles and understanding of, quote, our new kind of American string playing. What is that style?
My concept is to try to allow the student to partake in classical training, which is a great tradition, as everyone knows, but also jazz violin and different improvisational styles, as well as some great traditional fiddling styles that have also been around for hundreds of years. And when you when you're exposed to those things as a student, you're likely to bring those things with you. It's like you're a tugboat and you tow along your life and musical experiences. So when you're looking for new groups to perform in or new music to perform as adult and professional musicians, some of these things will come back into your profession. And I think that we see now a lot of musicians taking this on, and I'm identifying it as maybe a new American direction in string playing.
That sounds exciting. Now, you and Mari are going to play something now for us in the studio from your new album, Crossing Bridges. Tell us about this song, Olympic Reel.
Olympic Reel was written around the same time period as I was working with Yo-Yo Ma on the first project we did. I wrote Olympic Reel for the closing ceremonies at the Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia, and I got to perform it there at the right in the stadium field in front of 3.5 billion people watching on television around the world.
Intimidating.
Yes, and it qualifies as one of my bigger premieres, so I'm very happy about that.
Well, let's hear how it sounds live. Thank you.
really, if you closed your eyes, you could not really tell that there were two violins playing. At times, you were in unison completely. And Mari, as a protege of Mark, it must. How does it feel like to play with him?
It's great. If I remember back to before I even met Mark at his camp, the listening to the recordings, he's been such an inspiration. And if you'd told me back then that I would be able to not only learn his music but be able to play it with him, I would have laughed. I couldn't have believed it.
Well, hearing you talk about all the styles that you're bringing together, and you've played jazz, rock, straight-up country in your career, Mark, do you think you found your groove, or do you imagine crossing over another bridge that that you might not even know about yet?
I love all these musical bridges, and I thrive, you know, trying to discover them. I cultivate these musical crossings, and I often refer to them as edge effects, where being on the edge of one style with your hand out, reaching into the body of the next environment, the next musical environment. You know, I don't know what the future holds. I want to partake in different genres. Right now I have requests in from different like opera companies and ballet companies and things like this that want to...
opera and fiddling. It would be a first.
It has to be a first when if I'm involved, because, you know, this is uncharted territory, like a new journey for my own brand of violin playing.
Mark O'Connor, Mari Black, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
It was wonderful to be here with you and to play with Mari. What a great young talent here right from Boston.
Well, let's leave you with one of the songs that started it all, Appalachia Waltz, performed here by the Appalachia Waltz Trio from the new CD, Crossing Bridges. For more on that CD and the trio's touring schedule, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, Molly Hamill, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Shugartz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. And our interns are Jamie Ulrich, Lauren Morand, and Jessica Wall. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Robin Young is back on Monday. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Join us next time for the news and